Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our telephone talk program. My name is David Inch. Glad to have you with us. This morning, in this part of Focus 580, we will try to explore some territory that actually we've been over before, but I think it's worth re-exploring because for people who aren't scientists, I think it's difficult. And it's worth trying to talk about and think about because if you look at the history of medical discoveries, what we're talking about here may well be the biggest, maybe the most important medical research project that's ever been undertaken. And what we're talking about here is mapping and really understanding the human genetic material, that thing that's so often referred to as the blueprint for all of us, DNA. Our guest this morning is Dr. Eric Green. He works at the National Institutes of Health in Washington. He's senior investigator in chief of the genome technology branch. He's also director of the NIH Intramural Sequencing Center, and he's been involved in this research, doing it and watching it and thinking about it for quite a long time. He's been at NIH since 1994, and before that did medical research at Washington University in St. Louis, where he got his PhD. He is both an MD and PhD doctor, and he's here visiting the campus. He gave a talk yesterday. We'll be doing some other things. This is all part of an initiative looking at the new biology that's being sponsored by the Center for Advanced Study on the U of I campus that, among other things, is the organization that's responsible for the MillerCom series. We've had a lot of those folks on the program. In fact, we'll have a couple this week. This is something a little bit different, a program that's involves some talks and some visitors this semester and next semester, and we will have a number of them here on the program. So for people outside of Champaign-Urbana, you'll have the opportunity to hear from them. As we talk this morning with Eric Green, your questions certainly are welcome. All you need to do to be part of the conversation is pick up the telephone and dial the number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. That's good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. So at any point here, if you have questions, you're welcome to call. All we ask of people is they just try to be brief just so we can keep things moving along, but anybody can join the conversation. 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Well, thanks very much.
My pleasure to be here.
I appreciate it. If maybe I'll ask a question like this to start. If we go back to Watson and Crick, the guys who discovered DNA, this was, I think, was 1948?
Well, they discovered the structure of DNA.
Who identified the structure of DNA. So I guess we had the – what I'm thinking about is, at that point, what it was we knew. So I guess we knew that there was this stuff, and this determined what we are, what we look like, and all of that. And we knew what it looked like. It was this twisted helix structure.
Two strands.
Yeah. So people, right, maybe, you know, they've seen pictures of it. They, right, kind of had this idea of what it looks like. But past that point, how much did we really know?
We didn't know a whole lot, but the inside of the structure paved the way to understanding that it was the DNA that transmitted the genetic information from one generation to another, or from one cell to another. This was the package. This was the material that encoded all the necessary elements of life. And up until that point, there was some confusion. There was some debate. But once they understood the structure of DNA, it became very clear how all of this fit together and how it was that the genetic material was fundamentally encoded in this chemical called DNA.
And, okay, so here let me ask a basic dumb person on the street question. Then the relationship between genes and DNA.
Ah, so DNA is simply the material that consists of four different chemicals. One starts with G, one starts with A, one starts with T, one starts with C. That's why you always hear DNA represented in Gs, As, Ts, and Cs. And it's basically information content coded in the order of those letters across a stretch of DNA. And the human genome, for example, we all have our genetic blueprint that consists of about 3 billion of these letters in a very precise order. In certain parts of that order are certain words. Those words are the genes. Those are the things that actually make something. So embedded in this long, long string of letters is information, and some of that information are actual genes that actually encode for something that makes, for example, a protein.
Mm-hmm. And the genes live on the chromosomes?
Ah, so chromosomes, I like to think of the chromosomes as sort of the suitcases that carry the DNA from one generation to the other. They are the structures that house our DNA, protect the DNA, take care of it, and make sure that when cells divide, all the DNA gets properly sorted so that that each new cell gets an appropriate set of blueprints. Mm-hmm. And same applies when you go from one generation to the next. And that's what chromosomes are.
All right. And then in every cell that has a nucleus has chromosomes in it.
Yes, certainly that's the case.
Okay. Right. So that's why you can sample different kinds of things. You can have skin, you can have blood, you can get different kinds of body tissue and extract from that the DNA, and that's why you can take that and you can tell what person did this come from, because that's in.
That's right. And in fact, your skin cells carry the same DNA as your brain cells, as your hair cell. All that is the same DNA. Mm-hmm. And it absolutely is very specific to each individual.
Okay. So then going back to what we knew before we actually started to look at the DNA, to sort of take it apart to try to look at what the various these pieces were, that we knew that this was the code for a human being or for other sorts of creatures, mm-hmm. too. We knew that it was incredibly complex. The question was then, well, how exactly how is it made up, and how does it do then what it goes on to do?
Well, and in fact, the last thing you said is really the next phase. I mean, one thing we did know in the case of the human genome is that we had to order 3 billion bases. We they're there and they're in order. We need to determine what the order was, and we needed to understand then as a starting framework to go in and actually attempt to read that sequence once we've determined exactly what the order of all these letters are, starting at 1 and ending at 3 billion or so.
Okay. So there, the very first step is, you mentioned the fact that there are these, it's this long line of these four letters, essentially,
exactly.
If you look at it that way. So the very first thing that you had to do before anything else, one had to be able to say, well, this is the order in which the letters come. Just that,
yes.
That much.
And here's a metaphor that I really like to use because I think it is actually fairly accurate and it's relatively easy to digest, and it incorporates what you mentioned about chromosomes. Basically, what our chromosomes are encyclopedia volumes. From one end to the other, just as from page one to the last page of a given encyclopedia volume, are these series of letters. And every one of our chromosomes has something on the order of 150 million of these letters. And we have 24 encyclopedia volumes. We have 24 chromosomes, 1 through 22, X and Y. And what the Genome Project essentially attempted to do was to take each volume one at a time and determine the precise order of the bases, the Gs, the As, the Ts, and the Cs, from the very beginning of that volume, from the very beginning of the chromosome, to the very end. And essentially, we are well on our way towards having that finished. There's still some more work to be done, but we have it fundamentally organized, each of the 24 volumes. They're all set. We know most of the letters. We know most of the order of all those letters. And we're entering a new exciting phase where we want to start opening up those volumes and reading it and now interpreting it, having now organized it. Mm.
It seems that in the way that lay people talk about this, we may be using terms that to us seem to be the same thing, but to scientists mean something different. And so we talk about mapping, sequencing, and interpreting.
Yes.
Those, now to you, to me, that might seem sort of to be the same thing, but to you and other people who do this work, we're talking about three very different things.
So let me tell you what each of those things are. Mapping was getting these volumes organized one page after the other. This was done by laboratory work. The details aren't important, but you put your book together. Sequencing was actually opening up that book and reading the letters one at a time, figuring out what the first letter was to the 3 billionth letter was. That was sequencing. Interpreting is like a great novel, a great Hemingway novel. You may read it. You may have a lot of people read it, but it takes many, many years of careful scholarly work before you can fully interpret what it means. That is the phase we are just entering into now,
right,
is the interpretive phase.
And that's because now, again, a lot of the reporting on the issue has been what it is we think when we have accomplished that work, what it is we think that we can do with it. We talk about genetic medicine. But to get to that point, we have to have the interpretation done so that then we can not only say, this is how all this information is ordered, this is what it looks like, that it's still a step from that to say, now I can tell you what this, if we look at particular sections, I can tell you what that section does. We're still not at that point.
Well, we are in a very limited way. Maybe we understand this sentence here. We understand that paragraph there. Maybe we even understand this page in this volume. But we do not understand a small fraction of what we have ahead of us. But it's as if we've walked into a room which we've been grappling around with for a long time in the dark, and all of a sudden somebody threw a light on. And all of a sudden, it's a very complicated room and a lot of exciting things to go explore, but at least the light is on. At least you have the tool to fundamentally now start to ask much more sophisticated questions than you could previously.
Our guest this morning in this part of Focus 580 is Dr. Eric Green from the National Human Genome Research Institute. He is chief of the Genome Technology Branch and director of the NIH Intramural Sequencing Center. And he's here visiting the campus to talk with people here about the kind of work that he's been involved in and where things stand in this very, very large and complex research effort of coming to understand human genetic material, what it is and how it works. And that's what we're trying to do here this morning, talk about some of the basics. And your questions, of course, are welcome, 333-WILL or 955, or I think I goofed up at that up, 333-9455. I hope that's right. I've only done it about a half a billion times. 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. So my mind can only hold so many complicated things at one time. So when there was a big, in June of last year, there was this big announcement, huge press conference. That was when President Clinton was still there. We had the guys who were the leaders of both the private sector and the public efforts there. Great big thing, got lots of news coverage on the front page of all the newspapers. From that coverage, I suppose a casual observer would have thought, well, that's we're announcing the fact that we're done. Hooray, you know. But that's really not quite right. When that announcement was made, that press conference was held, what was it that they were celebrating at that point?
They were celebrating a spectacular milestone, but we really have to emphasize it was a milestone. Essentially, what was being announced at that point was the fact that the Genome Project had successfully derived a crude but fairly useful and comprehensive draft sequence of about 90% of the genome. By that, I mean that for all these encyclopedia volumes, we had filled about 90% of the pages with fairly accurate sequence. It wasn't perfect. Think of it like a rough draft of a paper you may be writing that maybe there was a typographical error here or there, and maybe there was some bad grammar, and maybe there we were even missing a sentence a couple of places. But fundamentally, we had a pretty good idea of what about 90% of our genetic blueprint looked like. And that was, considering how quick this happened, considering all of it was way ahead of schedule as it had been originally outlined for this program, it was exciting. And importantly, the other thing being announced was that all of this information, all of this new insight into our genetic blueprint was all available on the internet. And that scientists already were taking advantage of it even before it was truly finished to perfection level type quality, which is what we're working on now. But this was exciting, and that's what heralded that big announcement in June of 2000.
Now, there was also then this year, in February of this year, there was another sort of big announcement.
And the big announcement then was to announce that scientists had done what academic scientists typically do, is that in June of 2000, the announcement was, hey, all this has been accomplished and it's all out there on the internet for anyone to look at. Then all these scientists went back to the laboratory and back to the computer labs, and they spent the next 6 or so months starting to analyze this data, trying to start to do the first pass interpretation of what is it that our genetic blueprint actually looks like. And then they did what scientists do. They wrote some very significant papers that were published in very prominent journals, Nature and Science, and those journals then published these huge landmark papers in February of this year. And so there was another big announcement saying not only we accomplished it, we've now, you know, sort of published it and put it into the permanent literature archives, which is very important and very symbolic for science.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that I know, I'm sure that many scientists are pleased about and people who are interested in having access to this information is that the process that we've talked about is going more quickly than at one point we thought that it would. It seems that various points along the way, the target date, the date at which we thought important milestones would be hit, continue to get closer. You know, that is, at one point we thought it would take
till 2005.
Yeah, you know, and now we're saying, well, maybe we'll be done 2003.
Totally done.
You know, and I know that here to fully answer this question, one would have to get into the technology, the technique that maybe would be more complicated than you can do on the radio, but I guess I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about what it is that happened that has allowed the process to speed up as we have gone along.
I think this could best be summarized by just really emphasizing to you that the goal that was set out for the Genome Project captivated so many people's interest, even beyond biomedical science. It got engineers interested. It got computer scientists interested. It got physicists and chemists. People were very fundamentally exciting. Saw how exciting all of this was going to be, and it really brought to bear people that otherwise weren't doing genetics, weren't doing molecular biology. Their contributions in technology, in computer science, in physics, in chemistry, really resulted in some tremendous advances in instrumentation and the kind of tools that were necessary for doing DNA sequencing and doing the kind of manipulation we needed to do in order to accomplish this goal. And that just year after year resulted in accelerations that proved to end up resulting in a product that came in much sooner than any of us really anticipated in our wildest dreams.
Yeah. I guess, as I understand it, what has happened is that the process has largely been automated so that it's something that can be done. You create equipment, you put it together with computers, and that the machines essentially do the work.
It's very industrial. The process of large-scale sequencing, whether it be for sequencing the human genome or other genomes, has now been reduced to practice so that the laboratories doing this look much more like manufacturing plants than they do classic biology laboratories.
There have been two major sort of parts to this effort. There is a publicly funded effort that has involved you and other scientists like you and National Institute of Health and people like that. And then there has been a private sector effort. And this company, Celera Genomics, Greg Venter's company, has been involved in that. How exactly did that happen? I mean, how is it that we ended up with the public and the private efforts working ultimately working side by side?
Yeah, it's actually fair to go back actually to the beginning of the Genome Project. Even in the planning phases in the late 1980s, a lot of people thought the Genome Project was a bad idea because nobody would be interested in what it would produce. And ironically, as soon as the Genome Project began, there were lots of companies that started creeping up even long before Celera that thought that they could do things to complement what the public Genome Project was doing and potentially be able to develop products, to be able to sell subscription rights, to look at new data, and so forth. And Celera was just sort of one of many such companies. And Celera was basically started by the company that had developed the latest and newest and greatest DNA sequencing instrument. And their idea was, instead of just selling instruments, maybe we should get into the business of also sequencing, and maybe we should be trying to sequence the human genome and perhaps sell the ability to look at that data to companies and to academic labs and so forth. And so they proceeded to do that. They used a slightly different approach than the public Genome Project did. And in the end, I think this ended up being the press picked up on this as being somewhat of a rivalry. But in fact, they had very different agendas. The Genome Project in the long run is about completing the job. They're not worrying about making money. They're not worried about developing profits. They're releasing all of their data every single night on the internet. And Celera Genomics has a business plan that they want to extend what they're doing into arenas that may eventually be able to build a business around.
Mm-hmm. Well, are they now charging for access to what they have discovered?
Much of their sequence, you can only access it based on paying them a subscription fee.
Okay, so that there are certain kinds of data now that still, if you want it, you got to
absolutely
pay for it.
Absolutely.
Okay. We have a couple of callers here. We get people involved in the conversation. 333-9455 for Champaign-Urbana folks. Toll free, 800-222-9455. We first go to a local caller. This is someone in Champaign, and it's line one.
Hello. Hi. Mm-hmm. You're a very exciting speaker. Thank you for being on. We have had an evolution of this cell structure of life, the prokaryotic and the eukaryotic cells, and one produced just clones of the parent, and now we have the male-female duality here going. Are there any theories on how that change occurred from prokaryotic and eukaryotic cells?
You better explain what, for the rest of us who don't know, you better explain what that means first.
So I think the fundamental question the caller is asking is, you know, you have major classes of organisms. Prokaryotic organisms are like bacteria. These don't have nuclei, and they're much simpler organisms. Actually, their genetic blueprint is much, much, much smaller. Eukaryotic organisms are more complex organisms. Certainly humans are among them, but there's many, even the common brewer's yeast or bread yeast is a eukaryotic organism. And their genomes are typically bigger, and some of them are substantially bigger, like the human genome. And I think the caller was generally getting at, you know, what insight are we starting to get at a cellular level of what does it take to be a bacteria, a prokaryotic? What does it take to be a eukaryote with its more complex cellular machinery and nucleus and many of the things it can do? And it's a very good question. It's by far too broad of a question to try to address in a forum like this. I would stress that, and one thing I didn't mention, I think it is worth emphasizing because it really gets to the heart of what the caller is asking, is that the Human Genome Project was given the name human because it sounded good and it captivated people's imagination. But the truth is the project was broader than that. And from the beginning, actually long before sequencing the human genome, the project attempted to sequence and did successfully sequence the genomes of bacteria and of yeast and of the fruit fly and of worms. And all this was to develop a framework for being able to compare genetic blueprints to try to address the fundamental questions the caller has asked of what is it about a minimal genetic blueprint that results in a bacteria being as simple as it is, and then what does it take to enhance that a little to then become a eukaryotic cell? And then, of course, the next question is what does it take to then become a multicellular organism? And then we're interested in then what does it take to become a mammal? Then what does it take to become a primate? And then what does it take to become human? This is the heart of what we're getting at. I can't give a simple answer. I'm not sure we have a simple answer to his question. But finally, we're starting to get the tools that we need to start to ask and answer those questions by being able to lay out these different genetic blueprints, not on the table, we do it on the computer, and look at them and compare and start to really get great insight into the fundamental basis of what it means to be these different classes of organism.
Wonderful. Thank you.
All right. Thanks. I guess as I, maybe I'm misunderstanding the question, but it seems an interesting one, but an awfully large one, and that is that if you talk about the fact that there are some organisms that reproduces essentially by making copies of themselves,
sure,
and then you have others where you have two individuals, and what happens whose genetic material is different, and then every time they reproduce, it's like shuffling a pack of cards. You're getting something that's a little bit.
Yes, but you also
different.
Have organisms that are somewhere in between those two.
Oh.
So this is, you know, reproduction is just one example of increasing complexity you see as you go to more and more complex organisms.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, you could pick on that as a good example to look into, but I could give you lots of other biochemical examples of where eukaryotes are more complicated than prokaryotes, where multicellular organisms that may have a nervous system are more complicated than a yeast, for example,
yeah.
which does not.
Okay. So I guess I'm thinking, though, at some kind of basic level, I guess if you believe in natural selection, you would have to think that shuffling the pack would potentially give you more advantage than if you were doing a more simple kind of thing where each generation is pretty much the same as the generation that came
yes,
before.
But they're picking up genetic variation as they go along. They're doing that as well.
All right. To Aurora, line number four. Hello.
Yeah, sorry to say I came in late in the program and maybe some of these questions were answered. Well, one, what prompted the beginning of this project? And have you had a very surprising find, something that has really startled you in this? And I'll hang up and listen.
All right. Well, thank you for the question. Oh,
two very good questions. What originally started this, people could point to a variety of things that really can be traced back, a number of years, especially in the 1980s in particular. There were some advocates who thought that if we were ever going to understand cancer, for example, which fundamentally is a genetic disease, that we were just completely in the dark of understanding cancer without having a better understanding of our genetic blueprint. Other people believe just at a fundamental level that if we really want to understand lots of aspects of biology, that we just needed to once and for all decode genomes, and the human genome being one of them. Department of Energy actually deserves a lot of credit. They really spearheaded a lot of these early discussions. They were very interested to understand mutation. These are genetic changes that result from energy sources or energy exposures. And so they thought this was very important to try to elucidate the complete sequence of humans and other organisms. So that's really at the core. But also, I think with time, people recognize that if we were going to tackle the many diseases that have strong genetic predispositions and causes, we really needed to have better tools, and those tools had to come in a better understanding of our genetic blueprint. The second question.
Any big surprising finds?
There's so many surprising finds, even from the there's going to be so many more, I can guarantee you. One of the humorous ones that sometimes people like to just sort of mention, and this sort of came out from the papers that were published, is that paper published in February of this year, is that it looks like humans, you mentioned genes. Genes are the functional units. They're the key sentences in our genetic blueprints that actually make something, that make a protein. It seems on the surface that humans may only have maybe twice as many genes as the lowly fruit fly. And this was a real ego blow to mankind and womankind, because clearly we're so much more complicated than a fruit fly. How come we only have twice as many genes?
The issue is that over time people had made guesses.
They'd say,
it was based on the idea that we think we're very complicated in advance, so we have tons and tons of genes, lots more than other simpler animals. And one of the things we found out was that our estimate was way high.
Was way high, probably. Although it turns out we probably have we're even more complicated than Drosophila, because even with only twice as many genes, we probably can do funnier and different things with them to get greater functionality out of our genetic blueprint. And that's the kind of things we're going to be learning more and more about in the next decade.
Well, then, though, as we then do the sequencing and the analysis of simpler life forms than us, the laboratory mouse and the fruit fly and single-celled organisms and so forth, do we then think that we're going to come to the understanding that that there is certain material that is common to all of these?
There absolutely is.
And as you go along, you're taking some basic building blocks, and then when you get more complex, you're keeping those, but you're adding some more stuff, and then you're adding some more stuff, and you're adding some more stuff.
Exactly the case. And we're mixing and matching. That's what we're learning that we clearly do, is that, but we share many of the same genes with yeast and flies and worms, and we just have ways of using them in slightly more complicated fashion.
So then doing the mapping of yeast and flies and worms will not only give us an understanding of yeast and flies and worms, but that contributes to our understanding of humans.
Absolutely.
To Urbana here, line number two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Hi. Yeah. I was hoping that the speaker could answer a couple questions for me. I was wondering if he could talk about some of the ethical questions that scientists face in doing this research, and also some of the potential dangers of that the technology might produce. And I'm going to hang up and listen. Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
Well, I appreciate the caller's question, because I think it's a good one. It gives me a chance to talk about a very important and unique aspect of the Genome Project. Really unprecedented for a biomedical research program was that from the very beginning, from day one, the Genome Project earmarked a portion of its budget that would be solely used for the study of ethical, legal, and social implications of the research and the program. And this is called the ELSI program, ELSI. And there have been all sorts of important studies that have been done and policy programs that have been formulated as a result. And the reason for that is exactly what the caller alluded to. This is very powerful technology, very powerful tools, very powerful infrastructure that has been created. But it is a two-edged sword. It's like a lot of important technologies. It can be used for such good, But we have to be so cautious as a society to not let it be used for anything bad. And on the one side of the sword is a nice sharp edge that's going to provide us all new tools for attacking problems in medicine and human health and human disease. But on the other side of that sword is another sharp edge that, for example, could be used to discriminate against individuals who have a predisposition to a disease, to deny them health insurance, to deny them life insurance, to deny them a job. And we have to be very careful not to let that happen. We need to make sure that good comes out of this and that we have good, strong laws in place that will prevent this from being misused and used as a tool for discrimination. And there, the LC program has been very effective and continues to work very hard to try to get good, strong laws passed. Some states have done it. The federal government has done some of it. There's better laws that are still needed. But that is exactly something where we really have to make sure that, that good comes out of this. People are protected so that they learn to appreciate how useful this endeavor was rather than to feel threatened by it.
Back at, in the beginning when this project was proposed, I think that there were some medical researchers who were concerned that it that there was only so much money available to do medical research, all medical research. And the concern was that this project would be very expensive and would soak up a lot of that money, and that as a result there would be less money for research, and that there were things that maybe were deserving of funding that, that wouldn't get funded. Has this ended up costing as much as we at one time thought that it would?
And, well, actually, it's remarkable. It's coming out that the people who planned this, who in the 1980s, who actually had no idea what major technology developments were going to come to pass, they actually laid out a pretty good plan, even cost-wise, of what this would end up requiring. And they were pretty much on target, and it did not require a substantial amount more money. The critics that you mentioned, which clearly were quite vocal in the late 1980s, early 1990s, you don't hear from them as much. Actually, you do hear from many of them. Many of them have come forth and said, you know what, we were wrong, that this didn't end up sucking money out. You have to put this in perspective. Our whole institute, the National Human Genome Research Institute at NIH, has less than 5% of the total NIH budget, and we're supporting the bulk of the Genome Project's work in the United States. Part of it, remember, is that the Genome Project is not just about the United States. It's not just about the NIH. The DOE also contributes to this. It's an international project, and we had major international partners that came on board, and many countries contributed to this, and that actually helped substantially in getting the job done in a highly efficient fashion. I don't think in the end this has been detrimental to funding of research in the United States. I think it's just the opposite. I can tell you that being at the NIH, the number of times I've had opportunities to speak with very enthusiastic members of Congress who have really found the Genome Project to be an exciting thing they can point to as a success story, and it's I think it's really been part of the reason why NIH continues to do well in getting funding.
Well, is it the case that as things have gone along that people, particularly lay people, have picked up an appreciation for what this knowledge will enable us to do once we get to the point that we really have indeed gotten through with the interpreting of the genome, so we really understand exactly how it works, and then we get to the point of trying to, you know, when it's not working correctly, trying to do something about it?
I think we're at a very hard period of time now. I think for the general public in particular, there's a lot of new complicated information. You alluded to it at the beginning of the show. I mean, genetics is complicated, and all this new stuff of deciphering the genome is pretty complicated. And yet we're at a phase where we can't point to lots of examples to say, oh, and this led to this new treatment or it led to this new diagnostic test. I think we're going to have that in a small number of years. I don't think it's going to solve all of our health problems, but I think they're going to have, and there's even a few examples we can give already. I think with time, people are going to learn to appreciate, as good examples come forth, how this is really going to end up impacting the way medicine is practiced, at least for some diseases. And I think then it'll be much easier to sort of comprehend what has been accomplished.
Well, we talked about the fact that, again, there may be sort of terms that lay people would use loosely. We talked about mapping and sequencing and interpreting, and to the fact pointed to the fact that for people who do this work, we're talking about things that are really different. We also talked about the fact that as time goes along, it seems that the goals end up coming closer and closer. That is, it doesn't take as long as we thought. And that so we're thinking that now to complete the sequencing work, maybe by the spring of 2003, we're
yes.
thinking that that will be done. However, there's still this other step of interpreting. How long do we think that will take?
I don't think anybody should even feel confident to predict, because it's that is not going to be a defined endpoint. You could say it was easy to sort of say, or at least try to say, when you were going to determine the order of 3 billion bits of information. But interpreting is sort of, I like to make an analogy by saying, well, when will we fully understand a good Hemingway novel, a good Shakespearean play? I mean, when do we really understand that? I think lots of people could question that. You'll go on for decades still trying to reinterpret it. I think the human genetic blueprint is going to be probably just as complicated, I'm sure even more complicated. And so I think we can go through milestones. We could say, when will we have a full inventory of all of our genes? When will we have a full appreciation of what all of certain classes of sequences do? I think those sorts of questions could be answered and probably, but the even going back to one of the earlier callers, really understanding what is it in the blueprint that would allow a cell to be a eukaryotic cell, I wouldn't even want to venture to guess. I mean, this is really just the beginning of something. It's by no means the end of anything. And this could go on for decades. This is what all scientists and clinicians are now empowered with, this new information. And it's going to take a long time to fully interpret, but I think you'll start seeing benefits even at the very early interpretive steps.
Well, I'm sure the things that for your average person, the thing that they're going to be most interested in are genetic diseases that have genetic component. And I think now we're coming to appreciate that a wide variety of diseases probably do have genetic component.
Virtually all diseases.
Maybe almost everything. So it could be everything from diabetes to Alzheimer's disease. We think that maybe if we get a better understanding of the role that genes play, we can use that information to develop treatment methods. So I would expect that those are the kinds of things that we would be concentrating on, or at least to your average person, that's what they want to know is when are you going to be able to really use that to do something dramatic about cancer or heart disease or Alzheimer's or, you know, some range of things.
And that's exactly my point, is I think that's when people will start to be confronted with the fruits of the Genome Project, when they start to see it changing how they are treated as a patient, how the basically for certain diseases, how it may change diagnostics, how it may change therapeutics. But at the same time, we should be cautious. These are really hard problems. We have not completed anything. We've just provided a foundation for all new approaches for studying diseases. Yes, we could point to certain examples. I can tell you that since the Genome Project began, practically every week, another gene is found that is associated with specific disease. And it correlates very nicely with each year that the Genome Project marched on. More and more of these genes have been identified. And I'm sure people have heard about them, genes associated with breast cancer and Alzheimer's and so forth. Mm-hmm. And again, even that is a triumphant occasion, but at the same time, it's just like flipping the lights on in a room again. Now you actually understand what the genetic defect is. It doesn't necessarily tell you automatically how to fix it. And that's the next phase. But again, we're operating at a whole different level of sophistication by having a gene associated with a disease and being able to ask questions that previously you were completely in the dark about.
Yeah. And I guess, too, that there people should appreciate that it's maybe more complex than identifying a gene that's responsible for some problem, that we would go in and we could say, aha, this gene right here, this is the Alzheimer's gene. If we could just figure out how that works and why sometimes it works and doesn't, and we could fix it, well, then there would be no more Alzheimer's disease. It may indeed not be as simple and straightforward as one problem, one gene, and one fix.
And well, for some diseases, it's that simple. Cystic fibrosis is one that a lot of people are aware of. That's one gene. Now, there's a lot of different ways that gene can be changed or mutated, typographical errors, I like to think of it. But it is one gene causing one disease. But diseases like Alzheimer's or diabetes, hypertension, and the like, cancer, certainly, it's very clear that for many of those, it's going to end up being a series of maybe a handful or even more genetic changes in a series of different genes that are going to lead to a predisposition to a disease that maybe you'll get the disease, or maybe with certain environmental exposures or certain foods or so forth would lead to that disease. That's really complicated stuff. We would never be able to untangle that if we were constantly just trying to figure out what the letters were on the different pages of the book. Mm. It at least becomes approachable by having all of that in front of you and then being able to do studies in much more sophisticated ways.
Well, I know that this, you said that, rightly so, that making an estimate of how long things take is very difficult. But when we're thinking about getting to the point where we have substantially interpreted the sequence and that we are getting to a pretty good understanding of what's what and starting to think about applying that for a goodly number of human diseases, let's say, are we talking about more than 50 years, but less than 100 years? Or sort of what kind of time frame are we talking about?
I think over the next, I really believe that over the next 5 years, you're going to start to see a number of new diagnostic tests, for example. In fact, they already are out there, so that's why I can be confident saying it'll be the next 5 years, where we will be able to diagnose certain diseases based on DNA testing of individuals, and that may change certain things. I mean, point to, for example, we know so much more now about colon cancer than we knew even just a handful of years ago. And we know there are certain genes that if mutated, that individual is a much greater likelihood of developing colon cancer. And the reason that's very useful is that if we identify those individuals, that is something they can be screened for. And colon cancer is one of these examples that if you're screened and you're caught early enough and you're treated, the morbidity is significantly less than if this has gone unscreened and untreated and you catch it at a very late stage. These are the kind of examples. I think that's one for colon cancer. I think there's going to be others for other disorders that will then result in abilities to have lifestyle changes, preventative medicine that will yield benefits. What will be a little bit longer will be taking the genetic discovery and then going in and coming up with a treatment for it, being a new drug, being a gene therapy, or being some other type of therapy. Now, there are examples. There's some very exciting developments, one drug in particular for a certain form of leukemia that seems to be quite a significant advance. And that drug was actually designed by understanding at a genetic basis what was going wrong in that form of leukemia. And that's a nice example. But, you know, not all the other examples are going to come as quick as that. And it's going to be many years. I think you'll see incrementally over the next 5 years certain things, and over the next decade even more. And I'm hoping 50 years from now we're looking back on this and recognizing that, boy, we have come a long, long way. But I can't quite tell you exactly what the timetable is going to be.
About 10 minutes left, actually less than that, maybe more like 8 or 9 minutes in this part of Focus 580. We're speaking with Dr. Eric Green, Chief of the Genome Technology Branch, Director of the NIH Intramural Sequencing Center at the National Human Genome Research Institute. And your questions are welcome. If you'd like to join here the conversation, take the opportunity to call in now. Don't wait until the very end. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Here's a caller in Urbana, line number one. Hello?
Hello?
Yes.
With regard to the question of interpreting the data from the Human Genome Project, I want to ask the speaker to present his view on some of the most promising approaches for the interpretation. From my background, I'm mostly familiar with issues such as protein folding from the chemical side of things, as well as some of the association of genetic mutations with human diseases. General approaches that the speaker may be familiar with, I'd appreciate him commenting on.
Sure. It's an excellent question. I think there's going to be many different types of approaches that will have to be brought to bear on this very challenging aspect of interpretation. I will tell you my own personal view is there's two major things that are going to be done and have to be done. One of which was is actually very relevant to what the work that I do at the NIH is that one of the most powerful ways to interpret the human genetic blueprint is to basically sequence other organisms, get the genetic blueprint of other organisms, and then compare them. Basically, when you find sequences that are in common between, let's say, humans and mice, for example, when you see sequences in common, that is most often due to the fact that evolution has held those sequences in check because they're important. When you see sequences that are very different, then that's probably because they're not as important. So one of the ways to illuminate the important regions of our blueprint is by sequencing other blueprints of other animals, comparing it, and then figuring out what's in common is likely very important, and what's not in common is probably less important or else is unique to that particular animal. Now, this goes hand in hand with the second tool, which I think will increasingly be made more and more powerful, and that is better and better computer tools. I think without question that most of this interpretation is going to be done by very sophisticated computational exercises that are going to have ways of synthesizing the sequence, comparing the sequence, developing tools for identifying the different functional units within our sequence. And then I guess a third component, of course, will be additional complementary experimental work. But to think for a minute that it's going to be one modality that's going to result in interpretation is very naive. It's going to be several different approaches brought to bear. I think a lot of it's going to be centered around very good computational biology, though.
Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. And next person here is in Chicago, line 4. Hello.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a little late to the program, so if I ask a question and it's not what you're talking about, I apologize. I know you're talking about the human genome. So I was wondering what your guest thought of a national DNA data bank. I know that there's been talk about this, especially when it comes to convicted felons, you know, so that they can solve crimes easier, but there's been talk that maybe we can do it for more than just that, and I wondered about his opinion on that.
Yeah, it's a good question. It's a complicated question. It depends for what purposes you would want to be banking away DNA. I mean, one, you alluded to one, maybe for the purposes of sort of in a forensic arena, for having DNA available for testing in a criminology type way. And that's sort of one set of issues. Or another set of issues relate to, should we be collecting DNA from every new baby that's born for the purpose of being able to catalog whatever diseases that individual may get. And these are complicated studies, a lot of ethical issues associated with it. There's do people want to be giving away their DNA and what's going to happen to it? And I'm not sure you want to make a move like that until you have stronger protections so that, again, it's a two-sword issue. We don't want to have something come back that we meant to do something very good and end up coming back to haunt people. And so I think until there's better protections, we don't want to go too far in that direction.
Well, I understand that the military has already started to do it so that they can identify casualties. Is that true?
And I believe that to some extent that is true. But again, that's being done in a very focused way for very specific reasons. And so that's absolutely right. I think that would be within a different context for a specific reason.
Well, now, let me get this straight. If you took someone's DNA and you went to a crime scene and you found evidence of DNA there, what do you do? Do you run it through the computer? Is that the way it works?
In a brief answer, there are ways of essentially gaining a fingerprint, if you will, of that DNA. There are tests that can be done to look at very specific parts of someone's genetic blueprint, and by that everybody is unique. And so if you have that sample and you have some individual that you think may be a match, you can do tests at the DNA sequence level and absolutely determine if it is a match. And that's exactly the way forensics is done.
In other words, it's not a computer printout.
Well, I mean, the computers are involved in interpreting it, but essentially it's generating data at a DNA sequence level.
I see. Well, the thing is, we need to be careful, like you said, because I understand in the future you'll be able to determine whether someone will be able to get a disease or something like that. And if an insurance company got a hold of that, they could possibly deny you coverage.
That's exactly why we need better protections.
I'm going to have to jump in here. My apologies for cutting in on the call. I'm just going to have to do that because we have used our time and we're going to have to close out. We want to say to our guest, Eric Green, from the National Human Genome Research Institute at NIH, thanks very much.
My pleasure.
For being here.